Good morning. It's 6 after 9. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. 9 on Monday means it's time for All Things Political, where we discuss the political news of the past week. My guest this hour is Dennis Riley, Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Good morning, Professor Riley, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, and thanks.
Well, in spite of the fact that we had a Christmas holiday and a huge snowstorm that tied up a great deal of the country, we managed to generate quite a bit of political news over the past week. Well, let's start with the most recent first. Amazingly enough, it looks like the attempt at terrorism, which fizzled literally, is going to become a political issue. I'm shocked, of course, that that's happening. But let's talk about that for just a little bit. Of course, we're talking about the event that happened on the KLM flight coming into Detroit. A Nigerian man who was apparently on a watch list attempted to detonate an explosive. It didn't quite work. But now questions are coming out as to, okay, how did this guy manage to get on the plane with explosives and what's going on here? And, of course, there's been some back and forth on that.
Right. Well, it started out with the administration, or at least with Janet Napolitano, suggesting that, boy, this thing had really worked well once it started to unfold. Passengers, crew, she gave that one yesterday morning, but this morning she was a whole lot more subdued. They're really very frustrated that this guy got on the plane at all. The watch list thing is kind of difficult to monitor. If you've got 500,000 names you're supposed to keep track of. And there's always the question of, should somebody be on a watch list because his wealthy father says his kid has gotten out of hand? That's really all the evidence we had on the guy at the beginning. But still, everybody's unhappy that the actual liquid got on an airplane. That no one understands quite how that happened, and they've got to get to the bottom of that. And they've got to get to the bottom of it pretty quickly.
Well, yeah. Do you think that we've become a little complacent because it's been a while since anything serious has come up?
Probably. I mean, I don't know that the, quote, bureaucrats in charge, unquote, are any more complacent than usual in some sense. But the task is such a daunting one, and when you have long stretches of time when basically the only complaints about it are people grumbling about the inconvenience, it's kind of easy to think that maybe we do have a better handle on it than we actually have.
Well, and this person, I read in one report, and again, I've got, as usual, when I do a show like this, I have too many pieces of paper in front of me, but it seems to me this fellow was on a watch list, but he wasn't on the no-fly list. And
absolutely not, right.
Because we didn't think he would take an airplane or something. I don't know.
Well, probably because we don't put anybody on the don't-fly list without some fairly hard evidence that they have been engaged in this kind of planning. And I don't think anybody knew that he had. Now, if we're going to reach the point where we say, well, if you are Muslim and you have traveled to Yemen, you're now on a no-fly list, I suppose we could start to go in that direction. Or you have to prove that you can get off the no-fly list. You have to demonstrate to us that you don't have any connections to the kinds of folks that he now claims he does have connections to. It's just a very difficult thing for our security people to figure out how to keep relatively open borders, relatively free commerce with all of the world, and at the same time make sure that nobody gets on an airplane that shouldn't, quote, get on an airplane. I mean,
Yeah, this is, for the security people, this is a no-win scenario.
Absolutely. And they're going to take a pounding for the next few days, and they know it, and there really isn't very much they can do about it, because even though they do the best they can, or say they do the best they can, and probably do fairly well at it, this is just terribly frightening. Why didn't that explode? I don't know, but we're all glad it didn't. But if it had, what would have happened? So they can't win this one.
What's the likely political fallout for the Obama administration on this?
Oh, I suspect just a fairly small bump in the road, in the sense that they'll have to have a big study, and there'll be lots of stuff circulating and some criticisms made, and it'll probably all fade within a couple of weeks. So I don't think it's going to be a major kind of problem for them. It's a little more serious than the party crashers at the state dinner, but it'll be an embarrassment for a time. And the Homeland Security people, Janet Napolitano, will probably take the brunt of it if she can. She can figure out how to take the brunt of it because that's part of her job.
Well, and it just goes to prove that the president really can't ever take a vacation.
Well, that's true.
Well, he did get an early Christmas present from the Senate last week with the passage of the Senate's version of health care reform. Now the bill goes on to be reconciled with a measure that came out of the House quite a while ago. And we're already starting to see signs that the Democrats are stepping back from the public option.
Yeah, I think that probably the House Democrats are going to be forced to step back from that. They may be able to cobble together something that they can call a public option with an opt-out for the states or something, but they can't be guaranteed of that given the Senate rules and the fact that you need to pull together 60 people, and that means Joe Lieberman, and it means Ben Nelson, and they could lose even an Evan Bayh or Blanche Lincoln. They know that they have to hold on to the 60. They know the Republicans are going to put in nothing. So consequently, they really are pretty pinched. And I don't think the House leadership is going to say, well, we'll walk away from the bill and start over again in the spring of 2010. I don't think they're going to do that. So they'll have to pull the public option or disguise it in some way. They'll have to settle with the Senate on the abortion language. And there are some other things that are in there, but I think those are probably the things that will stick in most people's minds.
800-642-1234 is the toll-free number to call to join our discussion of all things political. Maybe you've got a political story you'd like to talk about. We'd like to hear from you on this Monday morning, the 28th of December, 2009, the year almost over. 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email. The address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We've already got a caller on the line. We're going to step back an issue. We'll probably go back to the security question. I want to take Tom in Green Bay right now. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. I think one of the problems that our government has right now is they're focusing so much and putting so much funding in Afghanistan that they forgot the homeland security. They don't have any face recognition computerized systems at every gate to each airport in the United States. They don't have them coming into the airports. They could do a heck of a lot better job if they would just put some money into it and not be so darn cheap, and probably withdraw back from Afghanistan and put more money into protecting our borders, protecting our people in our country, and surveillance for people coming into our country and what's going on in our country, because electronically they have the ability to do it.
The face recognition, if it had been at all the U.S. airports, this guy got on a plane and to come to the United States. Well, eventually it was in Amsterdam, but do you think we should be putting them at locations of all flights coming into the United States?
Well, I think that would be pretty difficult to do because we'd require the cooperation of those airports or of other airlines. I mean, I suppose we could tell KLM, Northwest, Continental, that whole conglomerate, you're going to use this technology at your gates. But is that, you know, can we make other international airlines over whom we don't have any control? Can we get them
Can
we get airports to do it?
Yeah. About the broader question of, you know, we had a lot of funding for Homeland Security initially after 9/11. Gosh, we couldn't throw money at things fast enough. I've still wondered, having talked to a lot of security people and a lot of local emergency management type people, if a lot of the money went to the right places. But we did spend a lot of money on security initially. Have we been slacking off? Have we backed off? And you know, Tom's got a concern here that we're spending a lot of money to fight terrorism in Afghanistan, but we're not maybe doing enough to make our borders more secure.
Yeah, well, that has been the central argument for almost this entire decade. To what extent do you fight, quote, terrorism, unquote, which is essentially a tactic rather than a set of people? Do you fight that by fighting what amounts to more or less conventional, even if you call them counterinsurgency, more or less conventional and extremely expensive wars in a particular place. And it's hard to say that the return on that, it's hard to say if the return on that has been good or if all that money devoted to a truly defensive posture would have done more. We don't know, I don't think, but that it's a good argument. I tend to fall on one side. That is, I tend to think we got way too aggressive in spending money in two countries to defeat, quote, terrorism, when a lot of defensive measures would have been much better uses of the money. But that's my conclusion.
Well, and we didn't do it for cash either. That was pretty much all borrowed money.
Well, that's true.
You know, two wars on the credit card.
That's right.
I'm going to give the phone number again, 800-642-1234. Thanks to Tom in Green Bay for calling. You could be next if you call 800-642-1234. What political news is on your mind today? Lots of stuff to pick from. We have talked already a little bit about that security issue. There was another issue. It turned out not to be an issue with another Nigerian person coming in on the same flight number into Detroit on KLM, who it just turned out he was very ill. But, you know, there's a heightened awareness of security now with this latest incident. Maybe you want to talk about that. Maybe you want to talk about the health care bill that the Senate passed, and now what's going to happen when the Senate and the House have to get together to reconcile the two measures. How are the Democrats going to come out of this with something they can stand behind in the 2010 elections? We've got some other things to talk about, too. There's a story on Politico just this morning about new groups joining the lobbying fray on climate change legislation that's pending in the House and Senate. They're working on that. Meanwhile, some leading Democrats in the Senate are telling President Obama to forget about getting a cap and trade bill passed in 2010. Just that's one thing too many, and they don't want to have to deal with it. We can talk about those issues. There are some state issues we can talk about. Lots of stuff that we can go through here this morning, and you can join in. 800-642-1234. If you get a busy signal, send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. Dennis Riley, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point, is my guest. We'll be right back with your phone calls in just a moment. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 20 after 9, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up later on today on the Ideas Network. Gene Purcell is in for Ben Marins this week, and it's been almost a year since President Obama took the oath of office. After 5, Gene and his guests discuss why President Obama continues to be a fascinating politician and presence to many people. That's coming up today after 5 o'clock on At Issue. This hour, it's all things political as we take a look at the political news of the past week. Kind of an odd week it was, with Christmas at the end of it taking up a couple of days. And that big snowstorm, I'm sure somebody will be able to make a political issue out of that. My guest this hour for All Things Political is Dennis Riley, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point. He joins me by phone, as does Paul in Cedarburg. Paul, good morning.
Good morning. I want to return to the security issue, if I could, just for a minute.
Sure, go ahead.
Yes, I'm frustrated that I don't hear the focus being put where I think it should be. If the guy was on the watch list, why wasn't he screened? Isn't that the answer? You know, you can talk about whether he should be on a no-fly list, but if he's on a watch list, then I think you should watch him and make sure that he is screened, and do that before you impose further restrictions on everybody else. Isn't that the obvious answer?
Well, what about it, Professor?
Well,
what do we do with people who are on a watch list?
But if the watch list is 500,000 people, as we've been told it is, I'm not sure exactly how carefully you can screen them all. And if the watch list is going to contain as many duplicate names as it no doubt does, you know, there's going to be lots of people with the same name, and then people that aren't on the list will have that same name. I mean, I'm sure there are these kinds of confusions that the security people are trying to sort out but aren't exactly sure how. I'm assuming that he was screened, but screened with either a technique or a set of equipment that simply did not detect the fairly sophisticated explosive he was planning to use. So maybe it's a hole in the technology, maybe it's a hole in the procedure. Maybe every one of those 500,000 people should be strip searched before they get on a plane. I don't know. But that's going to be pretty hard to pull off.
Well, again, it becomes a, in some respects, it becomes a resource question. And
it does. And a trade-off question.
Yeah, I mean, where do you draw the line? And just, Paul, if you're still there, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Okay, let's say we have 500,000 people on the watch list. How do you think they should be watched?
Well, I think that they need to be screened for sure. If you're, you don't just pick random people at the airport. If you have people that are supposedly being watched, you don't let them, from what I understand, he went through two airports without being screened.
Yeah, Professor, do you know?
I really don't know, but I find that somewhat difficult to believe, watch list or no watch list. That is, there's some minimal screening that goes on for all of us, and I would have assumed, particularly in Amsterdam, that he would have been screened at least in the same sense we all are, and that's supposed to be fairly decent detecting devices, I would think. Now, I may be wrong about all this. I'm not a security expert, so there may be huge holes in the screening in a place like Amsterdam and that I don't even know about.
Paul, thanks for your call. Clearly, some concerns and some frustration by people. It seems to me that part of what's going on here is we watch a lot of television programs and we see remarkable technologies on display for detecting and criminal activity and so forth. And this stuff exists, but it doesn't always work perfectly.
Well, presumably no technology always works perfectly, and so we do have that kind of a problem. Paul's implying, and if he's right, it's pretty scary, that no serious, sophisticated technology was used on this individual. And I would have thought at least some minimally invasive would be used on everybody.
Yeah, I guess the thing that bothers me about this is that we've kind of staked our lives, in a way, on our ability to detect explosives before they get on a plane.
Yeah, and apparently we weren't able to do so. Now, it could easily be that the folks who develop sophisticated explosives are just a couple of jumps ahead of us and don't have the same resource problems. They can deploy their sophisticated new explosives a lot quicker and easier. They have the money, and they go ahead and do it. And we have the catch-up-with-them technology that's a little bit slower. Maybe that's it. I don't know. But it is absolutely frightening if you spend much time on airplanes.
Yeah. John in Green Bay, you're next. John, good morning.
Yeah, hi. I actually want to carry this discussion about the airplane screening a bit further. I was listening to a radio station I stream online out of Austin, Texas. Hello?
Yeah, hang on. We got a telephone issue here.
Okay.
There we go.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
And there was a report that a couple returning from some kind of holiday or something witnessed this person being helped onto the airplane by somebody. He didn't have a passport, and the person was claiming that he was a Sudanese refugee, and that apparently, since it's difficult for Sudanese refugees to obtain passports and seek asylum in other countries, That's one of the ways this person is able to get on an airplane. And I find it remarkable that, despite the screening, I find it remarkable that someone could get on an international flight without a passport. But this has never been, talked about in the general media. I'd like to hear what your guest has to say about this.
Boy, I would have no idea. The question, verification of that particular report. There are a lot of eyewitness reports that never turn out to be verified, so I really don't know. If, in fact, I certainly was never able to get on an international flight without a passport, and I don't look any scarier than the average middle-aged professor. So I don't. I can't. I need one, so I don't know how that would have worked at all.
Mm-hmm.
Can't make any sense out of it.
Well, maybe this will come out, and we'll find out more about it. Who knows? Let's take one more call on this issue, and then we'll try to move on. I know we got some people who want to talk about health care. Mike in Appleton, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Let me try to clarify a few things here in this appalling situation. First of all, this guy bought this one-way ticket cash. That was known. Secondly, he arrived at the airport without any luggage. Two red flags. Thirdly, and what is absolutely astonishing, is apparently his family, I think his father, went to the U.S. Embassy in Nigeria and said, hey, watch out for this guy. He's acting nutty. And, you know what this all boils down to? And your guest said, well, what, are we supposed to strip search 500,000 people who are on the list? No. Let's boil it down to strip searching 200 or 300 people who are going to get on the plane, just like LL does. They have no problems because they do it correctly. Our problem is, of course, political correctness. What happened in this guy's case, the same thing with this Major Hassan. Everybody's terrified to say the word Muslim. That is reality.
Professor?
Well, you only strip search the 300 that are going to get on this plane and the 300 that are going to get on the next plane and the next plane and the next plane and the next plane. Or everybody with that name, whatever plane they want to get on, then we do it. Now, maybe that's the appropriate thing to do. And indeed, it's true that LL has a lot fewer problems than some other airlines have, and they have stricter security measures and reasonably fewer flights. But nonetheless, I don't know. I have no security expert credentials whatever, so I don't mean to suggest it. I think there are some serious difficulties in extending the LL model to all international flights, but maybe we should do it. I mean, there are a lot of reasons to want to be even more secure than we are now. So, yeah, and I'm quite unaware of his purchase of the ticket one-way cash with no luggage. I thought that red flagged anybody. And if, in fact, that's what he did, I have no reason to doubt Mike, that if that's what he did, then I am astounded that he wasn't pulled aside out of a line and said, you know, we have to take some extra precautions with you for the following reasons. Those do seem like two red flags, and they seem pretty big red flags. So maybe we are just complacent at this point.
I was not aware you could still buy airplane tickets for cash.
I wasn't either.
I thought you had to use some form of plastic.
Well, I would have thought so, but I'm not.
Interesting. Kind of security expert. Well, see, it's one of the great things about being on this program is you learn something new every day.
Yes, you do.
Let's move on to another issue here. We'll take Jim in Boston next. Jim, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Well, I am concerned and would like a discussion to revolve around why Democrats are backing away from the public option. If the key to successful reform is containment of costs, how can we rely on the insurance industry to self-regulate when they never have? And what is the explanation for Democrats not challenging the corporate interests of the insurance industry? And I'll listen to my response on the line.
Jim, thanks for the call. Professor?
Okay. Well, those are really good questions, and there's a whole set of very frustrated Democrats at the fact that the public option seems to have become a casualty, and have become a casualty when it wouldn't have been a casualty if the majority of the Senate, 51 votes, had been enough to carry the day. There would have been some sort of public option. It was the 60-vote rule that just put that off the table. And cost containment may not be the single biggest issue involved here. It may not be the Democrats' primary goal, but it is one of the president's big goals, and it's a goal that we've got to address. And certainly my limited knowledge of these kinds of questions suggest that without the public option, cost containment is going to be problematic. But cost containment is also going to depend on a different medical model, a different model of medical practice that will have to come through more than just a public option. It would have to come through a different way of changing the fee-for-service system and, you know, a whole lot of fairly major restructuring that I don't know that this bill or any bill that was coming up in 2009 was going to truly address.
Well, you know, that's and you know, going to Jim's point, there's the focus of the debate has been about the public option, but
right.
the public option was never really about cost containment. The public option was about coverage and about making insurance rates affordable, but that's only one part of the cost equation. And if we don't address, as you mentioned, the fee-for-service model and so forth, and the sort of economic incentives for the types of medical procedures that are performed, then you really you really aren't going to be able to succeed in making significant changes in the cost of healthcare.
Right. If you hold the line on increases in insurance costs, that's nice, but that's not going to hold the line on increases in medical costs. So we have to address both, and I don't think the public option was meant to address much more than to alter the insurance part of it and put some competition in and maybe force private insurance companies to behave in a somewhat more reasonable fashion, all of which are reasonable goals, but I don't know that they're cost containment in a significant way.
Well, I'm going to take a little risk here and probably get myself into some trouble. But given the fact that a lot of the opposition in the Senate was based on we don't want President Obama to get a win on health care, why not just go the nuclear option and say, look, we're going to do this with reconciliation and you know, too bad. It's happening.
Yeah, I think that might have happened. It's just that Harry Reid is not of a mindset to go through with that. I think his view was, let's get something that we can get out on time. Let's preserve the sort of notion of the way the Senate works because we have battles to fight next year. So let's not throw that glove down in front of Ben Nelson and some of the others. Let's just get what we can get and cut a deal with the House and move on and come back and refine this thing later on, although I can't imagine the stomach for another health care fight.
Well, that's just it. You really only, right from the start, they said, we've got one shot at this.
Yeah, and I think that's true. So, I mean, I think it'll be revisited, but it's not going to be revisited before 2013, and that's a long time off. So I just don't know. I was tempted to think, why not the nuclear option? Let's just go ahead and go forward, since there won't be any Republican votes anyway, and we can let some Democrats save their own hides by going where they want to go. But the decision was to try to protect the rules of the Senate and the way of doing business and all this other sort of stuff, and I guess that's how Harry Reid got to be majority leader, that he wouldn't ram anything down the throats of an unruly 60-member caucus.
Let's see. Let's take Eddie in Chicago next. Eddie, good morning.
Good morning. What I wanted to know is I was all for the buy-in at 55 and where you could pay to buy insurance across state lines, shop around. And the public option, well, plus or minus, I hear a lot of arguments about that. But the thing I really want to know, what's the difference in 55 votes opposed to 60 votes? Why is 60 votes so important? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, the 60 votes that's the Senate rule. If you don't have 60 votes, then you can't bring a bill up for a vote. That's it. I mean, you can pass it with 51, but to debate it, to cut off debate and actually say tomorrow at noon we vote, you need 60 votes. Those are the Senate rules.
Yeah, and we don't really force the actual filibuster itself. I mean,
no,
the
we don't
threat
anymore.
Is enough.
I mean, that used to be so entertaining when I was a young political scientist. Make them do it. Make them get out there and read Hamlet, you know, whatever they're going to do, but make them stand on the floor and talk and make them have enough people to show up and do it. And all this. And we've gotten away from that. It's now just a simple test vote. You get 60, you get to go forward to the next stage. You don't get 60, you put it out to pasture. And that's pretty huge change, really, from the Senate when I was at Michigan all those years ago and then in the first part of my teaching career. It's just completely different.
Mm-hmm. Tom in Richland, you'll be next. Tom,
thank you. Yes, good morning. The problem with the healthcare debate is we started out talking about healthcare and we ended up talking about health insurance, and that was a ploy by the people who didn't want to make it happen. And it's clear that we lost that. As soon as you talk about health insurance, how it's got to cost more. The savings come from not using health insurance. They come from a Medicare for all kind of idea. So I support a single payer in Wisconsin. We had a version called Healthy Wisconsin. compromise, and I support that, or a full single payer. And state by state, let's make it happen. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Tom.
Interesting idea. I'm not 100% sure it can be made to work state by state, and I'm certain that there are a lot of states that wouldn't even be willing to entertain the idea. But ultimately, many people believe, but apparently not a majority, that a single payer plan, that single payer being the government, as it is in Canada and elsewhere, is probably the only viable model for providing quality care at a reasonable price. But there are other models in Europe that do so much better than we do at delivering better healthcare outcomes at a lower cost, and yet still use heavily regulated private insurance companies. So it's really an intriguing business. But I don't know that the debate was ever really about reforming healthcare in the sense of let's have a different model of delivering the care itself. Because a single payer doesn't change the delivery of the care. It changes the financing system for the care.
Let's see. Let's take David next from Sauk County. David, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show. My comment is about the comparison of the votes in this last week in the Senate on, if you compare the votes on the health care passage, it was 60 to 39. Only 39 senators would vote for that. And on the same week, the military budget, senators approved 88 to 10 to appropriate $636 billion from the U.S. military and just in the U.S. fiscal year of 2010, including $128 billion for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So the question I have is, when it does come to cost, and people speaking about the cost of this health care bill, they always, they made adjustments. They said, well, this is way too expensive. It's going to cost $1 trillion. And they made adjustments to say, well, we won't start certain aspects until 2014. And they said, but they've been talking about $1 trillion over 10 years, which amounts to $100 billion per year. So my question is, well, how is it that our priorities are such that we can spend $600-some billion in 1 year on a war or on military, but we can't even, we can't justify $100 billion for the health of our own citizens?
Well, politically, it's a pretty straightforward comparison. Nobody ever got challenged in a primary election or a general election with the statement, you didn't vote to spend money on health care. But everybody's deadly afraid of being charged with not voting to support the troops. A Russ Feingold can survive a vote like that. People almost expect it of him. But there aren't all that many senators who are going to be willing to say, I'm going to vote against this because of the wars or whatever it happens to be. Pretty tough to do.
Yeah, that's the nature of the beast. Let's take a break. When we come back, we have some more callers and other issues to talk about. I'd like to. We'll probably take one more or maybe even two more calls on the on the health debate. I won't call it health care or health insurance. I'll just call it the health debate. And we also want to talk about climate change and some other stuff that's in the political news and try and cover some state issues, too. I'll just toss a couple of things out here as we go to the break, Professor. One of them is now for the eighth time. Supreme Court Justice Gableman has been asked to recuse himself on a case by criminal defense lawyers. And I want to talk about that. There's also the state passed a new drunk driving law. There's some other state issues we might touch on, too. Maybe some callers want to get in on that. Here's the number. Lines are available for you right now, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email address is talk@WPR.org. We'll be right back. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:42. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next hour, I'll be talking about baseball. In fact, we'll be talking about one of the greatest all-time Major League Baseball managers, Joe McCarthy, who managed the Bronx Bombers in the 30s and early 40s. Well, he created something called the Ten Commandments of Baseball. We'll talk about those commandments and how they still apply today and how they apply to life, as well as in baseball. There's a new book out by J.D. Thorne. We'll have Mr. Thorne with us after the news at the top of the hour. This hour, it's All Things Political, and my guest is Dennis Riley, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. We'll take one more call on the health issue, and then I want to move on to another topic. So let's take Randy in Kewaskum.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I'm listening to this, and you have all these people saying, well, we need to have Medicare for all. It's so wonderful. The thing is, Medicare is part of the problem. Medicare's reimbursement rate is raising insurance rates because the cost gets passed over to them. I have a sister who's a nurse. She said Medicare pays less than half of their cost. So basically, that's a 50% loss for every Medicare patient they take. And you're adding more to this system and saying it's going to save money. Basically, what it's going to do, we're going to have the rationing that you keep saying that there isn't going to be. You know, the price tag is going to balloon. I have never seen a federal program that the initial cost is, you know, estimates are anywhere near what they say they are. If they say it's $800 billion, let's say it's going to be $2 trillion by time they get it figured out. And it's, you know, I'm self-employed. I grew up a dairy farmer. I work 90 hours a week, and I'm basically going to be going to working 100 hours a week because I'm going to have to lay somebody off because I can't afford to pay him, because it basically they're going to be reaching in my pocket to pay for this garbage. And a lot of the people that are for it are people that have it in their head that they're going to get free health insurance from the government and somebody else is going to get to pay for it. Well, that's me. I'm self-employed.
Professor?
Well, there's an awful lot in there to think about. Medicare does keep its reimbursement rates artificially low and then eventually raises or somehow puts more money into that system at crucial moments. It does keep them artificially low, and there's some evidence that drives up other insurance costs. There's a lot of evidence that uninsured people drive up other insurance costs. Uninsured people have nothing. There's no reimbursement that heads in the direction of the hospitals, and particularly emergency rooms, which treat so many uninsured. So that has to be covered by something. I mean, Randy's sister has to be paid, fair enough. Doctors have to be paid. Hospital lights have to be kept on. So the money has to come from someplace. Some of it comes from us as taxpayers. Some of it comes from us as insurance payers. You know, I mean, the money does circulate in the system, and there's not much you can do about that sort of thing. It has to come from somewhere. That's why so many people prefer. But again, when I say so many, I don't mean a majority, because that's not the case yet. But why many people recommend a single-payer system where you have one giant kitty, tax-funded, there's no question about it, but one giant kitty from which everyone draws, everyone gets paid. Insurance works when you have a huge pool with a lot of people who don't have to use it.
Well, the notion that we do not have rationed care now has always been an interesting one to me.
Well, we ration care in part by income. I mean, the type of care, the quality of care comes in part by income or by, you know, in my case, not income, but my employer. The state of Wisconsin is a remarkably generous employer when it comes to providing health insurance. And so, you know, I'm fine. And so when my wife got very ill this year, we're fine. This had no economic impact on us at all, except driving to Marshfield episodically. That's about all it was. So, yeah, I mean, we do ration it. There are people who die because they don't have any serious access to health care. They don't even know they can go to an emergency room, or by the time they get there, it's too late to save them. So we do ration care. I have an unemployed daughter who rations her own care very, very, very carefully, because she knows she can't afford to go more than once every once in a while till till she gets insurance at a new job. So, yeah, we do ration it.
Okay, well, let's move on to another issue, and we'll let Ken in Oshkosh introduce it for us. Ken, good morning. Thanks for holding.
Good morning. Possible solution to the climate problem. Back before 2000, there was an experiment done in the South Pacific in which they used allotropic iron to green about an area the size of Connecticut. They estimated that the amount of intake of CO2 from that greening could take all of the CO2 that we produced since the 1800s out of the atmosphere within 10 years. I was concerned because that's also an area for the krill upwelling, and I'm afraid that that would mess that up. However, they're now starting to talk about introducing particles into the upper atmosphere, about possibly releasing certain greenhouse gases, so that they can cut down on the radiation. So there is an area, the Black Sea, which is anoxic on the bottom, has only about 40 species of fish in the top 100 feet or so of the sea, and it's landlocked. So instead of the thousands of freighters which would be needed to green an area of the Pacific, you could actually have from a land-based area a constant greening in the upper area of the Black Sea and use that as a CO2 sink and perhaps some type of remuneration to the countries around there that would do the actual work and essentially absorb all of the carbon dioxide we have produced since the 1800s.
Professor, there may be a scientific solution to climate change, and we might not have to face economic ruin at all. Huh?
Wow. Can I take a minute and call my son-in-law, the biology professor? He's actually a fish specialist. I'd sure like to have his input right about now. I'm in way over my not-too-scientific head, but it would be marvelous if such a solution was out there in some way, shape, or form. But is the CO2 problem the sole, does that fix it for us? I mean, I'm not even sure I know that much.
Well, let's talk about the political dimension, though, of this. If you can make the claim, look, we don't have to do anything because science is going to solve this problem for us, that changes the nature of the debate somewhat.
Well, it does, and that's very, very much in the mainstream of American political thinking from the very beginning. We're just immersed in technological solutions for things. I go way back, so I go back to when we were going to solve our energy dependence problems by squeezing the oil out of the shale in the Rocky Mountains. So we're going to solve whatever the problem is less by behavioral change than by technological change. That's deeply ingrained in the American psyche. And so I'd love to think that something like changing the Black Sea for 100 feet down would save me from having to think seriously about a different kind of automobile or a different kind of heating plant for my house or any of the rest of that, or even just behaving differently on the planet. I'd love to believe that, but I'm not sure that I have the scientific background to say one way or the other.
Ken, thanks for the call. We have lines available if you'd like to talk about climate change or one of the other issues we brought up. It should be interesting if we would get any calls on some state political issues. Here's the number, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email address is talk@WPR.org. Well, Professor, leading Democrats in the Senate, or at least moderate Democrats in the Senate, are urging the White House to give up now on any effort to pass a cap-and-trade bill next year.
Yeah, and I think that they may very well be able to force that off the table. Now, it may be that President Obama feels he's got enough in it already that he's got to continue to push in a sort of public pro forma way. But I don't think he's going to move those guys on that, especially not if he wants some financial institution regulation before the 2010 elections.
Well, and that's really what this boils down to, is the Democrats have to get ready to defend their majority, and it's been, in some ways, a tough year for them.
It has been a very tough year for them, and clearly they're going to want to do a complete pivot onto a jobs bill in both the House and the Senate pretty soon. And he's got jobs, he's got financial re-regulation. I don't know that cap and trade could elbow its way ahead of those two in the queue, which is going to upset some House members who had to vote on cap and trade earlier. They would love to have an opportunity not to have to defend that vote when they go out in the fall.
Yeah, let's just talk about that for a moment. We've got a few minutes here at the end of the program, and no callers right now, so I want to just toss this out here, Professor. I mean, you look at the beginning, where we were a year ago at this time, what the atmosphere was like. There was a real sense of we were still in this sort of euphoria after the election. The Democrats were on top. They were going to do something about the economy and about health care and about all of this stuff. They managed to pass the stimulus bill, which is now being harshly criticized, even though I think only about half the stimulus money has actually been spent. What a difference 12 months can make. And, of course, another 12 months and we may see something completely different. But it started out to be a terrific year for the Democrats, and now they're seen to be really struggling.
Yeah, and they're going to have some trouble. I mean, they're going to lose some House seats. There's no question about that. The president's party always loses House seats in the first off-year election after he has been elected, or ultimately someday she has been elected. That just goes back forever, so that's likely to happen. Maybe some Senate seats as well, because that 60 is kind of artificially high. So we'll just have to see how that plays out as well. But, yeah, they've got some political troubles. It's very hard to defend the proposition that you think it's bad now. If we hadn't done what we did, it'd be a lot worse. That's probably true. It's sort of conventional wisdom almost among economists now. But it's just a hard case to make, you know, that if we hadn't done this, it would be a lot worse. Well, it doesn't look so good right now, so what do you mean it would be a lot worse? So they have all that to worry about. The money needs to flow out. They probably need to try to convert some of that TARP money into direct jobs programs, although the Republicans will carp at that. They'll fight that all the way. So it's going to be a really interesting year in some respects. But you talk about a year that's going to be interesting in terms of the state. The state's political landscape is really going to change. There's no question about that.
You know, expand on that, please.
Years, and 20 of those years, either Tommy Thompson or Jim Doyle was governor. Not even, won't be now. I mean, not next year, but the year after. And the year will be spent getting some idea of who's going to lead Wisconsin into the next decade.
Or who wants to handle the hot potato.
Or who wants to do that. Yeah, it hasn't been a lot of fun, I don't think, since the Democrats took over in the fall of 2008, because essentially all they've been able to do is help the governor cut the budget in ways that are less painful to their constituencies than other constituencies. I mean, there really hasn't been much in terms of exciting new stuff that we can do. Some movement on medical assistance, on the Medicaid program, that they've done. But now we find out this morning that there's a $1 billion hole in it.
Well, and it's going to keep getting worse. And until, yeah. I mean, it's easy to be governor when the economy is good.
It's sure a lot easier, yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's a lot more fun. And particularly, of course, as a relatively liberal Democrat anyway, and Jim Doyle, and someone who wanted that job. I mean, he sort of stood there in the wings and watched Tommy and really wanted that job and got it, and had it through some now very rough economic times. And probably doesn't have nearly as much to leave behind as he thought he would.
Well, and if you look at the state budget, you know, and people who talk about, well, we need to cut more. Well, you know, if you take a look at what the actual discretionary portion of that budget is, it's a pretty small piece of the pie.
Yeah, it is. And that's true at virtually all levels of government. I mean, now they did through the furloughs and through a variety of other things, they made some significant reductions in that budget, but there's just so much stuff that you can't really cut. And now, certainly here in Stevens Point, but I think all over the state, you've got school districts that are begging their voters and being turned down yet again, and so they're trying to cut salaries and cut programs, you know, for all kinds of people, school districts, city governments, county governments, the last 2 years, 3 years, everybody's just been desperate to cut their budgets because they can't raise any additional revenue.
Well, in the I used to work in the retail grocery industry many years ago, and my store manager always said, volume cures all ills. And if the economy gets back up and we start getting, you know, the kinds of tax collections that we were used to in the 80s and 90s, then some of these problems will become different problems.
Well,
but we're out of time to discuss them today, Professor, so we'll just have to leave it there.
Okay. Thank you very much, John.
Dennis Reilly, Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Thank you for joining us this morning. This program was produced by Rodna Fanning with Bill Martins and Berta McQuaid on production on the on-air end of it. Thank them for their work. If you want to hear this program again, go to our website, WPR.org, click on the Kathleen Dunn link, and it should be right there. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Stick around. We'll talk baseball and the Ten Commandments of baseball after the news. This is the Ideas Network.